2023, and I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, would you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Medina?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Mr. Nguyen?
Present.
Okay, we have quorum and may proceed.
Is there a motion to approve the September 13th regular session executive session minutes as drafted?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion to approve the minutes passes. Before discussing the cases scheduled for review today, I do have some important information to share for everyone in attendance. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statutes 32-2081H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on the agenda or refer to them all to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-208H1. Upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A2 to review confidential records, or subsection A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Ms. Elizabeth Campbell. Please be aware that the chair reserves the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon the parties present. Please use initials only for patients, children, and the complainant. In addition, do not state specific diagnoses in the open session. Instead, please state the diagnosis on record. Be aware that the content of many records involving these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. A person or representative of a person who has filed a complaint and is present today's meeting may make a brief statement to the committee up to 5 minutes only when prompted by the chair. Additionally, the licensee or the respondent who is the subject of the complaint will also have an opportunity to make a brief 5-minute statement only when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after the statement is made. Please note that the individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make the request during the case review. For everyone in attendance today, please ensure that your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondent, and their legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note the individuals in attendance who speak without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. And if the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter the meeting. The first complaint scheduled for review is case number 2402 against, I'm going to probably mispronounce the name, but I can be corrected later. Bhupen Bhutani, Dr. Medina, would you please provide the brief overview of this complaint since you are the lead?
Sure thing, Mr. Chairman. So this is the summary for complaint number 24-02 against Dr. Bhupen Bhutani, holder of license number 4207, issued on February 23, 2012. Dr. Bhutani is a professor and associate program director for the Clinical Psychology Doctoral Program at Midwestern University. Complainant MG started receiving therapy services at the Therapy Institute at Midwestern University, where doctoral students provide therapy services to members of the public in 2021. Doctoral students are supervised by the clinic coordinator, who is an independently licensed psychologist and not part of this complaint. In 2022, MG was transferred to a different doctoral student to continue therapy services. RW was the new therapist. In February 2023, MG contacted the clinic coordinator with concerns about RW, and as a result, MG was placed on a wait list as there were no other male student therapists available, and MG had requested a male therapist. In mid-March 2023, a meeting was held by clinic staff as there were concerns regarding MG's treatment of clinic staff. Dr. Bhutani was present at this meeting with the staff. Dr. Bhutani met with MG at the end of March 2023 to discuss his concerns. After the meeting, there were several emails exchanged by Dr. Bhutani and MG. In April 2023, the clinic coordinator issued a letter to MG indicating that he would be removed from the waitlist due to various concerns regarding his conduct. A referral list to other providers was provided to MG. In July 2023, MG filed a complaint against Dr. Bhutani alleging that his patient rights were violated, that his medical record was altered, and that Dr. Bhutani made inappropriate comments during their meeting, causing MG significant distress. This concludes my summary to the committee.
Thank you very much, Dr. Medina. Is the complainant MG present? If so, I see on there. If so, you can unmute yourself, state your initials only for the record, and this is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. The committee may have some questions following your statement. MG?
Good morning, members of the Board of Psychology Examiners. I do have a prepared statement. I have come appealing to your attention today for a deeply troubling and disturbing matter of utmost gravity involving a clinical psychologist affiliated with Midwestern University. My purpose today in addressing this esteemed body is to convey the severity and the complexity of the issues that I've experienced with the hope that you will take the appropriate measures to restore justice and to uphold the integrity of this profession of psychology. Since March, I have endured months of psychological abuse at the hands of professionals in your profession, for those who are clinical psychologists, and the psychologists in question. These actions have not only violated my rights, but have also caused me emotional severe harm and psychological abuse. These traumatic events are not only isolated incidents, but are part of a sustained pattern of misconduct that have left me emotionally scarred and psychologically traumatized. To this committee, I sought out the Arizona APA president, some staff at the University of Arizona psychology clinical director, and one of his colleagues, and they had deep concerns, all of which had referred me to this board. When I shared the situation of betrayal, emotional and psychological abuse, along with several other state agencies, including Access Human Rights, Julie Dennis. I strongly assert that the misconduct perpetrated by this psychologist was not only was not only tolerated, but in some instances encouraged by Midwestern University and administration. The evidence that I have gathered suggests that there has been a concentrated effort to cover up egregious actions, leading to the obfuscation of accountability and a clear violation of professional responsibilities. Furthermore, it has come to my attention that the university president, Dr. G, who has been made aware of me by two city Glendale councilmen that know me and my reputation, reached out to her to bear some level of culpability in this matter. This is not a mere administrative oversight, but rather a betrayal of trust in the very institutions responsible for training and credentialing psychologists and higher medical education models here in Arizona. Adding to the complexity of this matter is the concerning role played by my student, therapist R.W. I believe that he was instructed not only by the clinical psychologist in question, but by university officials to cease communication and abandon me as a patient, exacerbating my pre-existing severe conditions of which I was seen for and causing emotional mental anguish. Those who issued those instructions should and must be held accountable to this board and to possible other state agencies of which I've communicated or plan to. Moreover, I would emphasize that my trauma was so severe that I want to make an apology to this board because I did not provide medical records from LDS Family Services, which I was required to utilize, and the Trevor Project. These are both professional, recognized mental health services and providers in the state of Arizona. And they were invaluable in helping me cope with the emotional trauma inflicted upon me. Additionally, my trust in this profession and the program at Midwestern has been profoundly shaken. I strongly believe that there's a need for independent review of the program, specifically concerning students such as mine, who may have been told that they did nothing wrong, and who have buried internal complaints within university measures. And it is vital to ensure that students receive proper guidance and supervision in their clinical program, and that they actually have compassion for their patient. In closing, I want that this board to be aware that on my last visit with RW, that not only he displayed a complete lack of compassion and understanding. His actions were deeply hurtful, and he seems to be acting on bad advice from staff and possibly administrators and others. Where I come from, we seek healing. As part of my religious affiliation, my First Amendment, I believe we're both under attack by this institution. And I want to make it clear that this case and situation of Midwestern University has garnered the attention of Governor Hobbs' office and the Chief Deputy Attorney General, Mr. Bill Mundell, who is further aware of this situation, as well as several state lawmakers that I am keenly involved with. In addition to not only this body, there are other state agencies that soon will, that are cabinet level agencies, be made aware of the egregious actions of Midwestern. And I share that with that body just for full transparency. But I am prepared to further pursue my rights to ensure that my rights and the members of the public can be protected. The suffering that I have endured is profound and beyond words. I firmly believe that not only were the standards of care breached, medical malpractice and intentional harm were inflicted upon me by colleagues of this individual, but it is wholly unacceptable for them to bury and shift the blame onto a patient who has become a victim, casting me as the problem with a two-page declaration full of falsehoods and accusations based in lies from April 10th. I kindly request that this board conducts a comprehensive, impartial investigation into the matters that I've brought forward, and bringing the full extent of the abuse, cover-up, and the impact of my life to light. I'm confident that the esteemed board will take the steps to ensure that justice and integrity of this profession is upheld. And I just appreciate being here today, and I'm happy to address any questions further pending. So thank you.
Thank you, MG. Does anybody on the committee have any questions for MG at this time? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. MG, thank you for being here this morning. I think it's always important to hear from public who reach out for services, especially mental health services. And I really appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. MG, thank you for being here, as Dr. Stewart previously stated. I hear, you know, your concerns. I'm wondering what, you know, since you stopped receiving services at the clinic at Midwestern, what has helped you address your mental health concerns since then?
Good morning, Dr. Medina. Let me start, if I may, to your question. Since February 15th, when the student, Reese Wetzel, basically intimidated me. And I want to start, if I may, just be very transparent, that we had a very deep therapeutic bond, the student and I, for over 6 months. It left me shattered in darkness. This whole experience where a student therapist said, I have a duty to report, tell me more. And I did not feel comfortable. I had already reported an incident. I was looking for compassion. And for those that are medically trained, I have never, in my experience, had any medical provider tell me or treat me like some piece of paper. So when we're dealing with sensitive information from a patient, and I am not a licensed psychologist, but I sure help friends. And I, too, have emotional intelligence. I'm not stupid. And so this whole experience of people who know how to get inside your head and gang up on you, they sure accomplished that to get rid of me. Cancel culture, to get rid of someone who is bringing to light a troubling, and I'm happy to provide it to this board if you did not receive it. Again, I apologize. LDS Family Services was late to get me my medical records. But at Midwestern University, the dean and higher ups had a complaint on this psychologist and other staff. I believe it was not only buried, but they shifted the blame. And what I'm trying to explain, Dr. Medina, is this. Since February, I went through Dr. Bhutani, of course, the university administration, he's on both sides, is a university administrator and psychologist. They wanted to get rid of you. And let me just explain one thing before I answer that, please. I had reached out to Reese a month after I was separated.
I'll interrupt. Just please use initials from here on out.
Okay. Excuse me. R.W. R.W. And Dr. Bhutani and others lied in wait. They lied in wait to say for over a year and a half to me as a patient, you can't email someone. There was nothing in writing to the University Patient Bill of Rights Handbook, which is a tiny little brochure that every patient is entitled to. That's in your First Amendment to be able to reach out. To LDS Family Services, my therapist still communicates from time to time. If we're going to censure and censure and sanction a patient who does not know APA rules, as this body does, and perhaps then that should have been made from the forefront to not communicate.
Excuse me, MG, I'm sorry. So are you currently receiving the treatment from LDS Family Services?
I was up until, I believe, July or June of this year, and I may have a few extra sessions that have just started. I'm trying to get to, from February and March to today, how dark and painful this journey has been to where therapy is supposed to help you. Since February 15th, it's reversed. I don't think I would be wasting my time and wasting this body's time. And frankly, members of the state of Arizona statewide officers' time. If I was not severely traumatized and also came from a place of severe darkness and pain. Like I said, I talked to the APA Arizona president and others of trust to say what had happened. They all said to come here, which is I'm happy to do. So yes, I am from time to time receiving services as an as-needed basis with very limited funding and availability. But I think that I just am trying to impose on this body, quite frankly, that, you know, patients not only expect to become better, but they place their trust with you. If that trust is broken and you're made out to be some, not only problem, but your character is tarnished, there's a severe problem. And this is an institutional attack that, as one clinical psychologist told me, became very defensive and lashed out. So what we have here is a severe institutional crisis, an educational and medical facility and staff that berated me and caused severe harm. And I've since obtained my medical records, and I was told that nothing was altered or changed, but I know what has happened, and I know that I've lived the experience. And I hope that this body understands that as a patient, I have rights. Human rights, medical rights. And all I'm trying to say very respectfully in closing to your question, Dr. Medina, yes, from time to time, thankfully, through my church, that service has been offered. But there has been a traumatic shift of new problems since this whole ordeal has come to light, including intimidation from stepping forward to government bodies such as yourself, from university officials.
Thank you, MG. Thank you for answering my question and for the explanation. That is my only question, Mr. Nguyen.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Medina. Any other questions for MG? Hearing none, Dr. Bhutani, I see that you're present. You may unmute yourself and state your full name for the record. And this is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes. And the committee may have questions for you as well.
Great. Thank you. I am Bhupen Bhutani. Good morning. And thank you for the opportunity to provide clarification and to respond to any questions the screening committee may have regarding MG's complaint. I have provided a comprehensive and detailed response to all questions raised in MG's complaint to the best of my knowledge, and have provided supplemental materials to support my response. The overarching fact that applies to MG's complaints is that I have never had a clinical or professional relationship with MG, never been a treating provider to MG, or provided a professional service directly or indirectly to him. I saw him once for an administrative meeting while he was not an active client at the clinic. More importantly, I have never accessed MG's clinical records at any time. All the details regarding my interactions with MG have been provided in Appendix A in my response. I hope the information I provide is sufficient for the Complaint Screening Committee, and I appreciate the opportunity today to respond to any questions regarding this complaint. Once again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Bhutani. Any questions from the committee for the doctor? Dr. Medina, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. Thank you for being here, Dr. Bhutani. So you shared that you had one meeting with MG for administrative matters issues. So what were your asks to MG during that meeting? What, if you can summarize that for us, please.
My asks to him, you mean? Maybe a little context. My understanding is that MG was on the wait list to be seen by a male therapist because he requested to be seen by a male therapist. And during that time, he was reaching out to all kinds of people, both within the clinic, outside the clinic, the president's office, vice presidents, people on our Chicago campus, inquiring about his status and also wanting to see his previous student therapist. Sent an email to an unpublished Midwestern email of the student that was a little concerning, making statements about wanting that he considers him more than a therapist, hoped that they can share their journey, be friends, and other things like that. And so it was a meeting called on March 20th by the clinic coordinator, the medical director at the clinic, the dean of College Health Sciences and Services, the program director, and then myself. That was my first formal introduction or awareness to the situation or MG. Because I was the only one that hadn't had a sort of contact with him, One of the ideas was to have someone meet with him to kind of get a sense of why he was calling, and to clarify really his status, which is that he was on the wait list, and also to provide a clear communication about how we're reviewing all of these communications, and to really just touch base with him. And I think in my response, I actually shared exactly what the purpose of the meeting was. And so there was no ask of him, except just to actually address his concerns, and also to clarify he's on the wait list, and that also to provide referrals if this wasn't an appropriate situation. I also went in depth explaining the student training nature of the clinic. I don't know if that answered your question, but.
Yeah, it did. I do have another question. Did you ever provide supervision to RW when RW was providing therapeutic services to MG?
Absolutely not. The clinic coordinator, it's her job, and that was the relationship. I have never spoken to RW about this situation. Any communication would have gone through his supervisor. So I have never spoken about this. So not even with supervision, I have not engaged in a conversation about this.
Okay, great. Thank you. No further questions from me.
Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. Dr. Bhutani, thank you for being here this morning. In your letter, just a couple of points. So the clinic coordinator was the direct supervisor of MG's student therapist, RW. Is that correct?
Yes.
At what point, I believe in your letter, you indicated that that MG would be on the waiting list, but because of perceived behaviors, that he was taken off the waiting list. Was he given appropriate referral sources?
So I'm not sure exactly where you're from, because I never had said that. It might have been in my response describing things that happened before I was actually involved. But my understanding is that he had made a complaint, not a complaint, but he had, as he described, had said that he had had this in a bad experience with the student therapist. And so there was a meeting with the clinic coordinator and the medical director. And then there was, he reached out to the dean, and the dean and them had discussed the situation, because he recanted what he said a few days later. And so he was, from my understanding, put on the wait list March 2nd. And that's what I know. What was the other part of your question? I'm sorry, Dr. Smith.
At what point was MG provided appropriate alternate services?
So it happened at least three times that I'm aware of. So my understanding is that it happened at the time that he met actually with the medical director and the clinic coordinator. It then happened when I met with him on March 29th, for the first and only time. I had provided him a referral. Then I believe at the time that the letter that the clinic coordinator sent to him on April 2nd with her decision, there was also a referrals provided. In each of these times also, he was offered the opportunity to come and talk personally too. But these were referrals that he could be seen. It was confirmed, from my understanding, that day if he needed to, and they were low cost.
Was there any follow-up to that? So those referral sources were made for MG. Was there any follow-up? Did anyone from the university, yourself or others, follow up that he actually took advantage of any other services?
Well, on the first two instances, and I can really speak only to the one that I provided, He said that he wanted to remain on the wait list, that he was not in need of services, and that he preferred to wait. And that's what he actually says in the two emails that he exchanges that I've provided. It's in his own words, and he was appreciative of the process in his emails to me, which you have. He actually went from wanting to, so after we met, he sent me one email confirming that he was on the wait list and that he had made a request to at least have a closure meeting with his previous student therapist. And so let me see. So then he sent me an email less than a week or a few days after, and he confirmed that. And then he sent me another email, and that was the only two I had, where he now was saying he wants to see this student therapist that he claims had, you know, sort of been not supportive or helpful to him. So those are the two emails. And then I can't speak at all to what happened outside of that, because that came from the clinic coordinator. But I can tell you he's been in constant communication, in the sense of contact with people. And in fact, yes, I'll just stop there. It's not like, And my understanding is from the records that he submitted in his complaint, he actually says the first service, he never mentioned this to me in my meeting, took place before he ever met me, which was on March 22nd. There's an indication of four meetings that he submitted in his complaint. I hadn't even met him until March 29th.
A follow-up question, if I may, Mr. Nguyen. Mm-hmm. Dr. Patani, you mentioned that MG requested a closure meeting to take place with him and mm-hmm. The therapist, RW. Mm-hmm. Who decided that was not to take place, and how is that communicated to MG?
So in my communication, when I met with him, I said that I would look into that possibility, communicate that to the clinic coordinator and those involved, and to give me 1 or 2 weeks, 2 weeks, I think, 1 or 2 weeks to get back to him. And the very next day, the very next morning, he started making calls again. And, I don't know if you want me to get into all of that. It's all in the response. But the issue is, it was never determined or decided. And so in the letter that the clinic coordinator sent, I really can't speak to that, because actually I saw it in his complaint, and it's very detailed. So I had nothing to do with that. I had no involvement, and I wasn't making that decision.
So who, with the structure of the university and the, mm-hmm. and the clinic, who would be in a position to make the decision to deny a closure meeting between MG and the student therapist, RW?
So I don't think it's an issue of denying, but given the nature of what happened, and there were several people involved, and given what had happened, and in my email, I did, in response, because MG had asked, I explained in great detail what would be the considerations. And I even spoke with MG at length about what the risks and benefits would be in my meeting with him. The decision would ultimately, and again, this is just from my perspective, would be made and supported by the person who knew the student therapist, knew the case, so it would be the clinic coordinator.
Okay. One, if I follow up on that, if I may. So
sure.
On the, because are you referencing the email that MG sent to RW? Are you referencing that as perhaps going into the thinking to deny the closure meeting?
No, absolutely not. That happened actually before I ever met him. And so that was actually the reason why contributed to the reason why somebody wanted to actually have a conversation and see what was happening.
Okay.
So actually at that point, when we had the conversation, it was still on the table. It's really on whether it would be helpful to the client, but also to the student, therapist, and that person has to be willing and their experience, which I don't want to speak to. And I also don't necessarily know firsthand. So those are things that would be decided, but it wasn't really about, about that, certainly at the time that I met him.
Okay. I have no further questions, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the committee for Dr. Bhutani or MG? Hearing none, the committee is going to begin deliberation. Please note, deliberation is the time for just committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. Dr. Medina, would you please begin the deliberation since you're the lead?
Sure, Mr. Nguyen. Thank you. I truly don't see, well, first of all, there is really no therapeutic relationship between Dr. Bhutani and MG. I don't see any ethical violations in terms of Dr. Bhutani's role, which was more of, meeting with MG from an administrative standpoint, given some concerns that were, had been brought up at the previous staff meeting. So I truly don't see any basis to, for the case, no ethical violations.
Dr. Stewart.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Nguyen. I have to agree with Dr. Medina. I'm not seeing, because of the lack of a formal therapeutic relationship between Dr. Bhutani and MG, I'm not seeing any. Dr. Bhutani was serving as a university administrator who happens to be a licensed psychologist. So I'm not finding things that would warrant referring this to the full board for either an ethical complaint or unprofessional conduct. I think there's an unfortunate situation, and I think MG is sincere in his complaint. And obviously he has some emotional turmoil that continues. I just don't think that in this particular instance that I'm seeing anything, against Dr. Bhutani that's actionable.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Dr. Medina, do we have any motion or any further discussion on this?
No further discussion. I move to dismiss the case against Dr. Bhutani. MG was never Dr. Bhutani's client. Dr. Bhutani was never the direct supervisor of the therapist. So there was really no therapeutic relationship there. And I don't see any ethical violations.
I second that motion.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Hearing no further discussion, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor of the motion to dismiss complaint number 2402, all say aye.
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 All those opposed, motion carries. Complaint number 2402 regarding Dr. Bhutani has been dismissed. The licensee will be notified in writing by the board staff in the near future regarding the committee's decision today. Thank you for all attended this case, and we're going to move on to the next case. The next complaint scheduled for review is case number 24-04 against Jared Deinhart. Dr. Stewart, would you please provide a brief overview of this complaint since you are the lead?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, complaint number 2404 against Jared Deinhart, PhD. Dr. Deinhart holds license number 3930. He graduated with his doctorate from Brigham Young in 2004, and his license is current and runs through 2024. The complaint overview is, another complicated case against Dr. Deinhart and apparently an independent licensed therapist in his practice. Dr. Deinhart and his spouse own a mental health treatment office, and the complainant BY is receive services from an independent therapist in that office. To complicate even further, BY had been married to Dr. Deinhardt's son, and they have a child together. There are suggestions that BY was seeking treatment in the state of Utah, but because of long wait lists, apparently it was offered that she could see someone in the Ironwood Counseling Center owned by Dr. Deinhardt. The complaint also reads that there was a dual role and violation of ethics between Dr. Deinhardt and the others in the clinic, that Dr. Deinhardt apparently had information and interpreted things and provided that to the independent therapist, and that's the role of the independent therapist took was based on the information provided by Dr. Deinhardt. There's also a suggestion that from the complainant that she was manipulated and coerced even to continue with the therapist in Dr. Deinhardt's practice. And that Dr. Deinhardt had even conducted counseling sessions with the complainant in Dr. Deinhardt's home. Further issues of the complaint is that when the complainant requested medical records, that she was stonewalled by Dr. Deinhardt's staff, and that she was denied access to her records. And the complainant indicates that she followed the protocol that's outlined in Ironwood's website, that she followed those steps in attempting to secure her medical records, and that even though she followed those steps, that the medical records were denied to her. And that's the end of the complaint.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart, for that a brief overview. I see the complainant BY is present. BY, please unmute yourself, state your initials only for the record, and this is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes, and the committee may have questions for you after that statement.
I would like to thank the committee for their time today. I would first like to start out by saying that my name, BY, I am Dr. Deinhardt's daughter-in-law, soon to be ex-daughter-in-law. I have known Dr. Deinhardt since 2007. Dr. Deinhardt set up therapy for me in his practice with my therapist, Ms. Palmer, who I have also personally known since 2015. I actually worked for this practice in 2015 and 2020, and I know all of their staff personally prior to my marriage. I will note that I made an error in my original complaint stating that I had therapy done at this practice in both September and December of 2022. I would like to correct that today and say I found after the fact it was only in December. The reason that I made this error was because in September of 2022, Dr. Deinhardt and his wife canceled me and my husband in their own home at that time. So that is why I got confused with the therapy dates. It still does not, however, change the basis of my original complaint. Dr. Deinhardt has done therapy in his own home with me 4 years, but said we would not call them sessions. He did EMDR with me in the walls of his own home in 2020 for very sensitive matters. I did not know this was unethical at the time. Once married in 2020, he and his wife would do sessions with my husband and I. After the birth of my son in June 2022, they would do sessions with me for my postpartum issues. I really thought they cared for me as I had known them for all these years. I was happy to accept their help as I could not find it as previously stated in Utah. I really believed that they were offering this help with my best intentions in mind and truly for my well-being. It was not until the demise of my marriage began in July of this year that I was told by my legal counsel it was even unethical what Jared Dinehart had done in regards to my mental health, and even unethical specifically in regards to him having me at his practice with when I was postpartum. I was told immediately by my legal counsel to have me rescind access to my records because they would try to use my records against me to take my son. I never had any diagnoses in my life or major mental health issues, only postpartum depression. I now know that Dr. Dinehart and his family took advantage of me when I was the most vulnerable, and I now feel that I was coerced into having therapy done at his practice. I would first like to draw your attention to the documents that I previously sent last week that Jared Dinehart helped file in the Utah courts on October 2nd. He helped file an emergency ex parte temporary restraining order for emergency custody of my son on the grounds of alleged mental health issues, with no provided documentation for these claims other than biased hearsay statements from his family. This order was filed by their son, my husband. Dr. Dinehart used his credentials as a licensed psychologist to abuse and circumvent the court system and file provable false allegations against me to give inappropriate custody recommendations to the Utah court and recommend that the Utah Attorney General take away my son immediately with a warrant. None of the parties involved even live in Utah. Dr. Dinehart disclosed patient privilege information, and he disclosed the information regarding this complaint and this hearing. My attorney was so concerned, she addressed this in her response, which I also provided previously. It is a conflict of interest for me to have even had therapy done at Dr. Dinehart's practice, even if it was with a separately licensed individual. My church paid for my care and would have done so no matter where I received this care. This proves that Dr. Dinehart and his wife only had me at their practice so they can know what was happening in regards to my mental health as their daughter-in-law. In my original complaint, I was worried about tampering of my records and unethical behavior. My doctor and I still have not received my requested records, which were requested on multiple occasions following protocol from this practice's website. These documents filed in the Utah courts validate my claims and the unethical behavior Dr. Dinehart has engaged in. Dr. Dinehart has falsely claimed in his affidavit to the court that he was never involved in my care, other than helping with childcare and transportation. This is false. I would like to point out the text I sent to the committee last week from December 11th of 2020, where on a family group chat, my husband to his mother says, "Bronwyn wants you and dad on the release of info form. And Heidi Dinehart says, fill out another one for us. Keep them separate." They then say that they will fill out, I will fill out these forms in the practice, which I have remembered doing. However, on July 6th and July 12th, their office staff claimed I never filled out this release of information. I then filled one out in person on July 6th, and then they later stated I filled it out incorrectly. This complaint is not retaliation. I have video and audio evidence showing what happened in the waiting room on both occasions that I politely asked for my records in full and for all prior access to be rescinded. It is not retaliation for a patient to request their own records. It is retaliation for a licensed psychologist to lie in court documents and to disclose patient privileged information to take away my son on baseless accusations. It is retaliation for this same licensed professional to retaliate against this patient's family, her mother, her sisters. The claims against my own mother, where an injunction of harassment was filed, are proven false with the audio evidence we have of what occurred in their office and with the unprofessional manner that their office staff treated us in. The intent of this complaint is to convey the abuse and harm that I have endured at the hands of this licensed professional, his staff, and his wife. My rights and privacy as a patient have been completely violated. Dr. Dinehart is trying to destroy my reputation and participating in a malicious smear campaign against me. I still do not have my requested records requested back on July 6th and multiple times thereafter. These issues of ethics call into question the mental health profession. I am powerless in this situation. I'm unsure of what else I can do. This is extremely suspicious behavior. If Dr. Dienhart has bravely lied to the Utah courts, this proves that his words today should be called into question. Again, I would like the committee to take into consideration the documentation and evidence provided. I would like the committee to note the issues of ethics in regards to the conflict of interest, dual relationship with Dr. Dienhart and Ms. Palmer, and the inappropriate and false custody recommendations made by Dr. Dienhart to the Utah court. I ask the committee to further investigate these issues.
Thank you, BY. Is there any questions for BY by the committee? Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. Thank you for being here, BY. From your statement, you received services at Dr. Dienhart's practice, not by him, but by another therapist.
Correct.
In December of 2022.
Correct.
Where were you residing in December 2022?
I was residing with my husband in Provo, Utah, and because we frequently visited our families in Arizona, our families have known each other for over 15 years. So they offered, because I could not find care in Utah during Christmas time, Dr. Dienhart offered to buy me an early flight for Christmas. And he said he found a therapist at his office, Ms. Palmer, that could get me in. And they set up when those sessions would occur. And during December, I did very intense EMDR therapy related specifically to my birth trauma.
Correct. So you were here in the state of Arizona. However, you were in 2022. And I understand from your statement, since this is going on in Utah, that you were a Utah resident. However,
yes, we were living in Utah until May. And then we moved out of state because my husband got a job in California. So we have not lived in Utah since May of 2023.
Okay. But at the time of the services, you were a resident of Utah. To your knowledge, was this therapist licensed in the state of Utah as well?
No, and I don't see how this is relevant. She's licensed in the state of Arizona.
I understand. And you were here visiting, correct?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. Okay. That was my question. Thank you.
Any other questions for BY? Hearing none. Dr. Dienhart, I see that you and your attorney are present. You may both unmute yourself, state your full name for the record. This is your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes, and the committee may have some questions for you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
My name is Jared Dienhart.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Dr. Dienhart.
No, I defer to you.
Okay. My name is Sarah Stark. I'm counsel for Dr. Dienhart, and this is Dr. Dienhart, as you heard. So I will try to be brief, and then I'll open it up to the committee members for any questions they may have. So as Dr. Stewart stated in his opening, this case has become complicated, mostly due to other ongoing proceedings, but also due to numerous different allegations that complainant has made, many of which are completely unfounded and unsupported by any of the evidences in this case, including, most importantly, the assertion that Dr. Dienhart performed therapy in his home with complainant. With that being said, I'm going to try to present the simplest version of what actually happened during the winter of 2022 when complainant engaged in therapy with a provider at Dr. Dienhart's practice. And it's important to note here also that this was months prior to any known conflict or marital issues between Dr. Dienhart's son and complainant, or the proceedings that are now currently pending in the Utah courts. As we stated in our written response, complainant's husband and his family, which includes Dr. Dienhart, became concerned about complainant's mental state after the birth of the couple's first child. Again, it is important to note here that Dr. Dienhart was in no way acting as complainant's clinician or engaging in any type of therapeutic relationship with complainant. In other words, Dr. Dienhart did not do any type of assessment or evaluation on complainant to determine she was suffering from mental health issues. Any layperson, which in this case also included other members of the Dienhart family, would have been concerned about complainant's well-being based on the comments she made to them and the symptoms she described to various members of the family. Dr. Deinhardt's son confided in him that complainant was having trouble finding a mental health practitioner in Utah where they resided. So she had not established care with a provider there. Dr. Deinhardt's son further indicated to Dr. Deinhardt that he was becoming increasingly concerned about complainant's mental health and believed that her problems may be escalating. The couple planned to be in town for the Christmas holidays, so Dr. Deinhardt asked his son and complainant if she would be interested in seeing a provider at his business while she waited to get in to see a Utah provider. This was intended to be a short-term temporary solution, as there was significant concern about her well-being at this time. Dr. Deinhardt was extremely cognizant and conscientious about the risk of a possible dual relationship here, and he took every necessary step to ensure that boundaries were not crossed. In fact, the investigative report is the first time he has ever even seen complainant's records as they were produced as part of this case. Complainant established care with Ms. Palmer as she had availability during the time complainant would be in Arizona. Complainant finished up her sessions with Ms. Palmer and the couple returned to Utah. Complainant engaged in one final session in January with Ms. Palmer after a quick trip to Arizona, which was the last time she was seen at the practice. Several months later, the couple's marriage became tumultuous, which apparently triggered this complaint as well as other legal proceedings. I want to note here that complainant has produced a pleading from a pending matter in Utah as part of this case. While I don't think it's appropriate for the committee or the board to attempt to litigate the same issues here that are being litigated in another venue, if the board is going to utilize that information as part of this proceeding, it is only appropriate that all of the affidavits be produced and considered, as complainant only provided board staff with a few documents out of many pleadings. There are statements and affidavits from other family members that were also used in these proceedings that corroborate and substantiate that Dr. Deinhardt was wearing his father-in-law cap, not his psychologist hat, and coming to his conclusions, as many of the other family members who are not clinically trained had the same observations and opinions about complainant's mental health here. Again, I know there's a lot of information. This is a complex case, so I will stop here. I'll see if the committee members have any questions for me or Dr. Deinhardt at this time. And again, we did cover a few more points in the written response, but I attempted to give a broad overview, so I'm not talking for too long here. So please let us know if you have any questions. Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Deinhardt or his attorney? Dr. Stewart.
Thank you, Chair. So Ms. Stark, I understand that the affidavit provided by Dr. Deinhardt to the Utah court, that there are additional records involved more than just that. The question arises, did Dr. Deinhardt give this affidavit as a father-in-law, a family member, or did Dr. Deinhardt provide this affidavit as a psychologist? And so taking this document by itself, he signs it, Jared Deinhardt, PhD, and that would suggest he's signing it as a clinician, as a psychologist. And on the last page of that affidavit, the last full paragraph is that they have other records that can be provided, including electronic health records, EHR. So has the line been crossed between clinical and forensic right there? I don't know if you'd like to probably answer that, being the attorney, but just signing a document for court with PhD suggests a clinician's hat.
Or is that something that I should answer?
Well, yeah, I think Dr. Deinhardt, if you want to take some of those questions and try to answer them, and then I can jump in if necessary.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart, for your question there. I was trying to be very careful with that affidavit, and you'll notice that it says EHR audit, because the only thing that I knew was that any investigation of an audit would show that my fingerprints aren't anywhere near it, that I had no knowledge of what was going on in any treatment whatsoever. The only knowledge I have is personal knowledge from personal interactions with my wife and with BY otherwise. So I was careful to say that's the only thing. I don't have access to any record other than do an audit and find out. And as for the signature, I sign PhD. What you might not know is any other communications we've had previously were through my personal email, and they're signed Dad. I signed it as I professionally would normally. I don't know if that was an unconscious anything, but that's what happened.
Thank you.
And Dr. Stewart, if I will add, that was sort of what I was trying to relate to when I was talking about the other affidavits, because again, when it's just one cherry picked affidavit, it you know, may appear one way, but there are other family members, including Dr. Deinhardt's daughter and his wife, neither of whom are clinicians, who had similar opinions and observations that may be pertinent to this discussion if you're going to get into, you know, the affidavits that were produced in the court case.
A follow-up question, if I may, Mr. Wynn.
Sure, Dr. Stewart.
The complainant states that you performed counseling services with her in your home. And I believe I read someplace prior to the marriage. In Ms. Stark's response, in your response to that allegation, you say that you vehemently deny that. Can you maybe shed a little light on this, or you may not be able to remember those?
I can do my best.
Sure.
What BY also said is that my wife and I did sessions, and I have no idea what she's referring to there. In my home, I happen to know a lot of psychology, and we talk all sorts of things as family. BY was correct in saying our families are very close. We've known each other for 15 years and spent Sunday dinners together and lots of time, and conversations would often go to life things. And when I was early trained in EMDR, I couldn't wait to tell people there's this great new therapy that I've learned about, and it's really fun for getting at trauma. Conversations, yes, there was no therapy done. In fact, I can recall multiple times with people requesting it that were family members, and I said, I can't do that. That is not my role as a professional. And I would hope that, as evidenced here, through all the conversations as a father, I would say, please go get help. Please go and see somebody in Utah. Please, this is important. And because that wasn't happening, I said, what can I do? I want to help. How can I do that? And one thing I might do is let me recommend somebody around me. And there were multiple people at my office. I recommended the one that had the most time that could possibly help as a stopgap. That was my intention as a father.
Thank you, Dr. Denner. Additionally, if I may, Chair, there's also a suggestion that you regularly do counseling sessions, in your home. Is your home set up? Do you have a home office that's isolated from the rest of the?
No, it's a house that I've never done home therapy.
Okay.
Not even telehealth. When everything moved to, with COVID responding, in the office is the only place I perform therapy in any way.
I have no further questions at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have one question. Dr. Deinhardt, has BY received her medical records yet? And if not, can you provide some explanation for that?
My knowledge, no. But my practice is independent contractors, and BY was very good to print off our website that says if there's any irregularity in a request, the provider should figure out what that is before releasing a mental health record. We've had some very squirrely attempts by people forging signatures and saying that they had a release when they didn't. So it's the provider that needs to make that decision. I'm in no way involved in whether a record is released or not released when the provider is the owner of the record. Ironwood Counseling is the custodian. So let's just say a provider left our practice. Then years later, somebody says, I would like to have my record. There has to be a custodian that can access that record and provide it with a duly effectuated request. I'm in no way involved with any record or release of record unless the provider has left our practice, and I would have to be one of the owners that could look in the record and give it. So that decision is completely up to the rendering provider. I'm never asked about releases of record for anyone except my own clients. Did that fully answer your question, Mr. Nguyen?
It did. Thank you. Dr. Stewart, do you have a follow-up or another question?
Yes. Segueing off that and into, you own the practice, and correct, a part of your practice, you provide the infrastructure for the individually licensed practitioners.
I'm sorry, there was a lag. I missed one section.
You provide the infrastructure.
Correct.
For the office space, secretarial services, including correct, the electronic health records.
Correct.
So on Mr. Nguyen's question, what's the disconnect if you own the infrastructure that provides the electronic health records? How is it that you exempt yourself from any responsibility for those records? Here's a person who obviously wants her medical records. She stated it. We have the documents, and she doesn't have them. Maybe the attorney can answer that. Ms. Starr, what?
Well, I think I'll make an initial comment on that. I think if you look in the file, there were requests, and the office staff, as well as the provider, explained to complainant that she had not filled out the forms correctly and that they needed her to fill out the forms in a certain way. She did not do it. There was a lot of communication between them about what forms they needed her to provide, and she did not provide the correct forms pursuant to the practice's policy. So, you know, there's voicemails even in the file that, you know, our office staff or either office staff or the provider calling and explaining to complainant, this is what we need from you. And for some reason, there was a disconnect in that, in her filling out the paperwork as they were requesting.
So,
Dr. Deinhardt, I don't know if you want to add on to any of that.
Please, yeah.
Right. So any request for information would have gone to the office staff and to the provider and never come to me because it wasn't my client.
What? So not filling out the form correctly. Could that, I'm wondering if that's not a part of what's at least interpreted by the complainant as stonewalling, that many, you know, she's requested the records, and then to tell her she didn't fill out the forms correctly, I have to raise an eyebrow of suspicion on this.
Dr. Stewart, I could agree with you on that.
Well,
go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think when I say, you know, it's not like, she, you know, she used the wrong color pen or something. She put the wrong name. She put her what maiden name on the form, and the records were under her married name. So there was a disconnect as to the name of the client in the records, which was the sticking point.
But even now, so in your descriptions, in your affidavit, and the family members' affidavits, your own son's statements, here's someone who's a vulnerable person at the time post-delivery, and she's vulnerable, emotionally vulnerable, and you're scared for her. And so you're not honoring a request. Obviously, she's requesting the medical records, and you're not honoring that because of she's not filling out the form correctly?
Thank you for the question. And I think this also speaks, Dr. Stewart, to the nature of the relationship, that I was in no way functioning as Dr. Deinhardt. I was in no way involved because I did honor her privacy and confidentiality, and I wanted no part of her medical record. All of those proceedings went directly, as they would for any client, through the office staff to her rendering provider. That's the way it always goes. That keeps a client's confidentiality. Somebody else doesn't get involved with that. I don't do that for any client. And so even a loving father can't step into a business that doesn't belong to his. Why would I do that? So as the owner of the EHR, is it technically possible that if I wanted to, I could try to get into the record? That's possible. Does the record have any evidence that happened? And the answer is no, because that was the agreement before even starting that I would never get involved because she needed confidentiality in this case. So it is the therapist that has ultimate say as to whether the record is released or not. I don't have any say in that until the therapist tells our staff to do so.
I expect Ms. Stark to have a very quick response to this question. And that is, who do you think owns her health records?
Well, as we have indicated, the subpoena was sent to the practice.
Who do you think has the office controls them? The office is the possessor of them, is a custodian. Who do you think owns those medical records? It's pretty clear, isn't it?
The EHR is owned by the office, which is,
right.
Yes.
And the patient owns her medical records. Is that not accurate, Ms. Stark?
That's correct. But again,
I move that we go into executive session for legal consultation.
Sorry, Dr. Medina, I know you had a question, but motion's on the table. Is there
a second?
Okay.
And committee members, just to clarify, this is an executive session for legal advice. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
Any discussion on that motion in the second? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, move into executive session. Okay, making sure everybody is back. It looks like so. I think we left it off where Dr. Medina still had another follow-up question. Dr. Medina? Oh, you're on mute.
Another signal of aging. Here we go. Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. Mr. Deinhardt, thank you for being here. In your previous statement, you stated that you wanted no part of BY's medical record. But yet you refer her to a therapist contracted by your practice, to where if they leave the practice, die, whatever happens, ultimately you're the owner of that practice, whatever mechanism it is in place, you are in some way sort of responsible for that record. So I think my question comes to, I'm a licensed psychologist. If I need to find someone, a therapist, I can do that. I don't need to go to someone from my practice. And so I'm wondering what efforts you put in place to find someone outside your practice first before referring BY to someone in your practice.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. And you're absolutely right. That was actually the first effort by all of our family was to find somebody in Utah, because that's where they lived. And that would have been where she could have received the services that were necessary. I don't know anybody in Utah that I could personally refer to. So my wife and I did some Google searching and say, here's some options for you. And that's why it was mentioned in the record in my response that we tried to get resources for Nathan or for my son and for BY, and they weren't taken. Any options that we might have recommended weren't taken. And when I was worried that her condition was getting worse, that's when as her father-in-law, I was thinking, what can I do as a stopgap? Because something's not happening. And what I heard was because nobody was taking clients and it's 3 months. So you're right. In Arizona, I wasn't looking for a variety of people in Arizona. I was trying to find somebody that she could see in a stopgap, essentially, until she could get through a wait list in Utah and get back to someone where she lived so that the condition wouldn't get worse.
So what you're saying is you didn't look...
I didn't research other providers in Arizona. No, I did not.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add something about the medical records conversation that we had prior to executive session. So I think Dr. Stewart asked me at the end there if complainant owned the records. And my intention was to convey that the provider, the practice, owned the records. So she has a right to get a copy of her records upon a written authorization, but the provider and or the practice is the owner of those medical records. So I just wanted to clarify that because I think there was some discussion at the end when y'all were trying to sign off, and I just wanted to make sure I did not misrepresent what I was trying to convey with that response.
Thank you. I see Dr. Medina, you still have your hand up. Maybe it was a mistake.
Oh, I apologize.
Okay. Are there any other questions from the committee, Dr. Medina, Dr. Stewart? Hearing none, the committee is not going to begin deliberation. Please note, deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case amongst themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any individuals. Dr. Stewart, since you're the lead, would you please begin the deliberation?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Certainly, it's a complicated case, and I think Dr. Deinhardt indicated at some point in his correspondence that that BY did perhaps research people to see therapists to see in Utah, but as I recall, she did not actually place herself on the waiting list for any of those places. And for convenience, I think that it was recommended that maybe to explore to see if one of the independent licensed therapists within his practice had time to see BY. And so I think that's how that came about. What concerns me immediately from this conversation is that BY still does not have her medical records. The practice obviously knows who she is. I mean, she's been there. They recognize her. And to say that because in the past there have been fraudulent signatures or something like that, and people trying to get records they're not entitled to, that obviously does not apply to BY. And so I have a strong opinion about her not being able to get her medical records. Yeah, I just want to make that statement. Everything else, the dual roles and things, I think have been adequately addressed by Dr. Deinhart. It's a he said, she said in terms of counseling services in the home where the formal counseling services are not. I don't think we know that. Being a member of his church group and perhaps at some point being asked to see people and doing something informally, perhaps that was done, perhaps not, I don't know. But the primary thing, signing an affidavit for the Utah court, and the enclosed content of that is very close to revealing information, privileged information. And signing his name, PhD, I think we all who have earned a degree, we introduce ourselves as doctor. And so I'm not, you know, that's easily explainable. So the primary thing is, does the affidavit to the Utah court, is that on that slippery slope of when a clinical case turns forensic? And so that's an issue. And the second thing is for me is that BY still does not have her medical records. Thank you, Ms. Twain.
Dr. Medina, anything to add to that? Any thoughts on that?
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. No, I agree with Dr. Stewart's points and summary. You know, to me, it's very close to that multiple relationship sort of aspect that we need to try to avoid. And while Dr. Deinhart had some measures in place, to be honest, I don't think they were sufficient, nor there could have been a lot more separation if she needed help to see someone who was not part of his practice because of the closeness. You know, she's not a friend of a friend. This is his daughter-in-law.
So. Yeah. And I'll just weigh in as well. I agree with both of you. I have concerns about the access to medical records, the multiple relationship, dual relationship, the closeness there, the affidavit, and his influence over that court proceeding in this way. So I have concerns among, I guess, a few different issues that we've discussed. Given that, is there any further deliberation? Further discussion on this? Okay, so I'm thinking we got to entertain a motion here, which it being a complex case, we may need to kind of talk about how that would look. Is there anyone willing to offer a motion on this? Dr. Stewart.
I'm the designated driver. So, yes, I move that the case be referred to the full board on for me, two specific areas. One is the dual role of clinician turned forensic examiner I don't know, Ms. Michelson or Ms. Pakanan will need to cite the area there, the statutes.
ARS 32-2061-15. And I think you're referring maybe to, DD ethical standard. And then yes. Were you thinking multiple relationships or were you thinking?
I'm thinking multiple relationships would cover
beyond the scope. Yes.
Clinical to forensic. And yep. Then the second point of concern would be access to medical records. And I'll rely upon staff again to cite that.
15-S.
Or CC maybe. CC is failing to make to client or their designated representative on written request a copy of their record.
CC then, yes.
Yeah, and so then, those are the two issues that I raise to be referred to the full board.
And that encompasses my concerns as well.
And Dr. Stewart, if I may, just to clarify on the possible ethical code violation, 3.05 is multiple relationships and 3.06 is conflict of interest. Was your motion including both of those or just one particular?
I think both.
Okay, thank you.
Second.
Any discussion on that motion, which I believe was clear. I think we made clear at this point. Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed? All right, the motion carries. So let's see. The complaint number 24-04 will be referred to the full board for review of the violations in that motion. I'm assuming I don't have to repeat them, do I? Offhand, because it's already in the record, right?
Correct, Mr. Chair. And I will notify the parties once a date has been determined for the board to review the case, and it will cite the potential violations that have been noted by the committee today.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. And thank you all for being here to discuss this. I know these issues are complex, and I appreciate everybody taking their time. Moving on to the next complaint on today's agenda.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Can we take a 5-minute break?
Oh, yes, sure.
If possible, sorry.
No, that's a great idea. We've been going for a little while here. How about we return at, let's just make it 10:20.
Thank you.
See you all soon. Seeing if everybody is back. We'll wait for a minute for Ms. Campbell, too.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Wynn, I'm here.
Okay. I think it looks like we're ready to go. Next complaint on today's agenda is case number 23-46 against John Mather. This complaint was reviewed by the committee at its last meeting on September 13th. The committee voted to table the matter and directed the board staff to issue a subpoena to Dr. Mather for his attendance at today's meeting, as he wasn't present at the September 13th meeting. As previously mentioned at the last CSC meeting, Dr. Mather filed a motion requesting the board not consider certain evidence in the matter that Dr. Mather contends was obtained illegally. The board considered Dr. Mather's motion to suppress on September 1st and voted to deny the motion. Thus, the board has already made a decision relative to the inclusion of the evidence in this case. This issue will not be reviewed by the committee. The only matter before the CSC today is whether Dr. Mather engaged in unprofessional conduct, and how the evidence filed in support of the complaint was obtained is not before this committee. Just to make that very clear, Dr. Medina, could you please provide the committee with a brief overview of the complaint since you're the lead?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Wynn. So this is complaint number 23-46 against Dr. John Mather, holder of Arizona license number 4056, issued on September 10th, 2009. In April 2023, the board received an anonymous complaint against Dr. Mather. The complaint raises allegations relative to conflict of interest and dual relationships. At the time the complaint was filed, Dr. Mather was in a relationship with a woman who resides in Brazil, referenced here hereinafter as partner. And in the complaint, three letters were included that were written by Dr. Mather in a professional capacity for his partner and a family member. Two of the letters dated January 2023 that contained recommendations for air accommodations and medical marijuana for the partner's mother, and one regarding the partner's travel to the U.S. and her accommodations at Dr. Mather's home. All letters were written on agency letterhead, referenced his psychology license, and included Dr. Mather's handwritten signature. In his response, Dr. Mather shared that neither his partner nor her family members were a client of his, that the letters were intended to be an example for partner to share with her mother about possibly obtaining something similar from her physicians in Brazil. The letters were not intended to be used in any clinical capacity, and also states that these letters were illegally obtained by possibly his ex-wife, also a licensed psychologist. No specific client is specified in the letters, And this concludes my summary to the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Medina. As this complaint was submitted anonymously, we're going to hear from the licensee next. Dr. Mather, I see that you and your attorney are present. Since you are, can you please unmute yourself, state your full names for the record, and this is your opportunity to make a brief statement for up to 5 minutes, and we may have some questions for you following that statement.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. Good morning, committee members, board staff. My name is Andrew Brimington, counsel for Dr. John Mather, who is also here with me. I'm going to make a couple of brief statements. I'm not going to belabor the points in our written submissions. I just like to point out that the entire conduct arose out of Dr. Mather's intimate personal relationship. The letters were sent attached to personal emails. They were hypothetical boilerplate templates to be to help mother, help some issues in her end of life depression. There was no client relationship. There was no professional relationship formed, so there can be no new relationship. There was only the personal relationship. There was also no risk of dissemination for these letters. Everybody knew what they were for. They were just there as hypothetical examples for partner to show mother. Then they were destroyed. I'd like to mention, I'm sure you haven't had a chance to read it yet, but a day or two ago, partner sent a detailed letter to the board, which basically corroborates everything Dr. Mather says and also makes some other points. I would ask that you do read that and include that in your deliberations, because I think it does corroborate Dr. Mather. And partner has also said many times that she wishes to be interviewed by the board so she can, provide her version of what happened. There was no risk of patient harm here, no risk of dissemination. For these reasons, we asked the committee to dismiss this matter. Now I'm going to pass it over to Dr. Mather, who's going to make a brief statement and then answer questions. Thank you. And of course, I'm available for questions as well.
Thank you. Good morning, committee members. I am Dr. Mather, John Mather. Thank you for your time today. Although I had hoped that the board would wait for confirmation related to the criminal conduct behind this complaint, which may include additional important information, I understand that it is the board's role to investigate complaints, including those written by my ex-wife, who is herself a licensed psychologist and subject to the jurisdiction of this board. To say my ex-wife's actions have caused my family significant pain and stress is an understatement. However, given my role as a psychologist, and I take that role and how I take that role as being a privilege and the responsibilities that go along with being a psychologist as being very important, and us having the highest levels of responsibility, I want you guys to know that I want to be here and address any and all concerns that you may have related to my conduct. Briefly, in summary, after numerous hours of direct personal discussions related to SK's terminally ill mother, we generated letters that SK and I understood were only intended for providing her mother with end-of-life hope, including showing SK's mother that she did, in fact, have access to accommodations, which SK had already legally obtained in Brazil to travel. Secondly, although there may be stigma associated with cannabis use and her mother was hesitant to use for those reasons, given she had already been provided with access to cannabis through her local Brazilian providers, the second letter talked about how she could consider using the cannabis made available to her locally as an option to treat the side effects that were horrifying that she was experiencing as a result of her ongoing chemotherapy. In our many family communications, we were all aware that these were not intended to be used for any purposes other than to provide information and meaningful examples related to SK's mother's options in Brazil. And we wanted to destigmatize the notion that her condition should be a point of embarrassment because she had access to accommodations for travel and she was embarrassed to do that, and that she may consider all options made available to her by her local Brazilian providers, including cannabis. Nothing communicated or exchanged was ever intended to be, nor were they ever disseminated to anyone in any clinical, medical, or professional capacity. In hindsight, I understand that the formal looking letters may have caused confusion if disseminated beyond my partner and if presented as representing a purpose they did not. With this said, again, I'm here to answer any questions that you may have related to the facts of this case and issues related to my professional conduct. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you both. Committee members, do you have any questions for Dr. Mather or his counsel? Dr. Medina?
Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. Dr. Mather and Mr. Brevinson, thank you for being here. My question is for Dr. Mather. I, you know, in your statement and in your complaint response, you assert that these letters were intended to be used as examples, right, of what could be obtained by the various parties, the mother or what have you. But can you explain why you use company letterhead and why sign them? Because when I think of, you know, giving someone, verbiage to write, I would write a paragraph in quotation marks or a couple paragraphs. It just seems not to be in context.
I think it's a great question. I appreciate it, Dr. Medina. Let me first and foremost say I wanted to address something in relation to travel for mom. She was unable to travel to the United States. So that was not the point of her travel. I just think that's clear. I want to make that clear because I think that's important. In relation to the letterhead, it's obviously a wonderful and important question. And the reality is SK and I talked on many occasions and in our discussions with mom, having some hesitancy there, we kind of came to the agreement that presenting something that looked more formal would have more meaning to mom. Hey, look, this is what can be done, or what John says, and these are examples of the accommodations and options that have been made available to you here. So this isn't something that's just out of nowhere, and you don't need to be embarrassed. You should have every opportunity to travel with the family, to enjoy your time, and to think about working with the people here that are recommending levels of intervention that you may not be comfortable with for religious reasons or for other reasons. It was always about hope, and our idea was that formal nature just gave it a little bit more kick for her to be like, oh, wow, this really is an option for me. The signature was not handwritten either. It was, sorry to cut back in here. I templated my Word document that I were to pull one up right now. It has my letterhead and my signature at the bottom. So we just created that in that context.
Thank you. No further questions for me.
Any other questions? Dr. Stewart, you have anything?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Dr. Mather and Mr. Brevinson, again, thank you for being here this morning. At no point, as I understand, and I did read the, Mr. Brevinson, I did read the letters submitted by Susamar Pluto, and I think she stated in the letter that she would like to address the board this morning as well. So I don't know if she is available or not, but if not, do you know the content of the letter well enough to respond to questions, or should I wait and see if Susamar can?
I believe she is on, but I can't see.
We think she may have called in.
I'm happy to respond as well.
Okay.
I'm so sorry to interrupt. I did, in fact, tell her that she would not be having to respond today. So I don't know if she's prepared to do so, but I'll, you know, if she would like to and you would like that to be a part of the process, she is on.
It does appear that SK is on. I do see in the participants an SK listed, which I assume is partner.
Okay, good. But you stated in your response, Dr. Mather, and this was reiterated in the letter from the Susamar, that you never had a professional relationship either with her nor with any of the family members, and that includes her mother and her brother. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
And do we mind referring to her as SK? I know she's a little nervous about this process.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Thank you.
And to follow up on Dr. Medina's question of why use company letterhead and signature, that certainly gives the impression of some type of rendering an opinion clinically. Let me ask, are you licensed in Brazil to practice?
Absolutely not. No, sir.
Okay. But this letter was only used internal to her family and was never intended for public use, nor for use of any medical body or practitioner. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I don't have any further questions.
Can I make one additional statement, or
is that okay to respond to that?
Just very quickly.
That's a response, sure.
Thank you very much. Sorry about that. I think context, again, is important. SK is a very, very bright, wonderful, intelligent, successful, hardworking individual, and she has ample experience actually working in the medical field in Brazil, her home country. She's very well aware of relationship guidelines, dual relationships. She's well aware of confidentiality. And she absolutely has any and all access that she could have ever needed at any point to support her mother locally, knowing that nothing I did, said, or anything of that nature could be of benefit to anyone in her family from a psychologist here in Arizona. So I just think it's important there that the context of who she is as an individual, and her knowledge and experience might be something to be considered in relation to, understanding that there was great levels of awareness of what the true intentions of this, of these interactions and these documents were.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Mather. Unless there's any further questions, hearing none, the committee is going to begin deliberation. Please note that deliberation is the time for the committee members to deliberate the case amongst themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, attorneys representing licensees, or any other individuals. Dr. Medina, since you're the lead, could you begin the deliberation?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Nguyen. I don't know how the letters were used, and they may very well have been an example of something that could have been obtained in another country. And, I believe that using the company letterhead and signature was a poor choice. Again, I don't have any evidence that they were used in a way to be deceiving. None of the people that it's mentioned there is a client of Dr. Mather that we're aware of. So I really don't see much to move this case forward to the full board.
Any discussion on that? Dr. Stewart, you got anything to add to it?
I certainly agree with Dr. Medina. I think it was maybe a question of judgment, poor judgment on Dr. Mather's part to use his company letterhead, but it's certainly well explained in terms of his response and then also this response that we received from SK. And for me, that explains things pretty well. So I'm not seeing anything actionable here at all.
And I'll just weigh in as well. I agree with both of your directions on this. Entertaining a motion, unless there's more discussion on this topic, entertaining a motion.
I move to dismiss the case against Dr. Mather, as I do not see that, there were any ethical violations or violations of our rules or statutes.
Second.
All right. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Hearing none. The motion to dismiss complaint number 23-46 has passed. The licensee will be notified in writing by the board staff in the near future of the committee's decision today. And thank you all for attending and participating today.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it. Looks like we're on the next agenda item. It's a big one. Agenda item number 5, adjournment. So moved. Is there a second? All right. We got discussion on adjournment. No. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. Motion carries. This meeting is adjourned at 10:39 a.m. on October 18th. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn.